Magnesium plays a critical role in vital bodily functions, including energy production, heart health, immunity, and more restful sleep. Magnesium is ubiquitous in metabolic pathways that affect virtually all organ systems. So I'm excited to tell you about MagSRT from Jigsaw Health. MagSRT has rightfully earned a reputation as the most popular, most bioavailable, and best-tolerated magnesium brands in the world. The developers of MagSRT have solved a problem that deters many from getting adequate intake of elemental magnesium. Their unique formulation is gentle on the stomach and doesn't produce unwanted GI effects. Jigsaw Health also offers MagSoothe, a great-tasting, fast-acting, calming magnesium glycinate powder that helps relax your legs, muscles, and brain for better sleep. Jigsaw MagSoothe helps you fall asleep faster, sleep better, and reduces leg cramps. For more information and to order MagSRT and MagSoothe, just go to jigsawhealth.com. That's jigsawhealth.com. Use coupon code HOFFMAN10 for $10 off your order. That's jigsawhealth.com and use code HOFFMAN10 for MagSRT and MagSoothe. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly opportunity to field your questions. And questions come to questions@drhoffman.net. Because the show is called Q&A with Layla, I'm obligated to co-host with a person named Layla.
That would be me.
It was tough to find someone with that name because it's a relatively uncommon name. But by an amazing coincidence, we have Layla Mutin, who's our resident nutritionist, to capably fulfill the role of Layla in Q&A with Layla. So our casting...
The role was created for me, don't you know?
Our casting call worked. It really worked.
Right.
So here we are once again answering questions, and I really enjoy our colloquy on a weekly basis because... Yep. Even when I don't know something, you just step right up and fill in the gaps.
I try.
Yep, absolutely. So together we are a whole brain, even though we are individually half-wits. So here we go. So before we get to questions, though, I came across an article which I thought was worth sharing, and it has to do with ALS. And unfortunately, ALS... is very challenging. They're trying to come up with medications to treat ALS, but in one of my articles that I think will drop this week or dropped last week, it's about medical breakthroughs that we don't really need. They keep coming up with ALS drugs, and I'm not exulting over this. I don't have Schadenfreude because, you know, I'm betting against high-tech medical breakthroughs, but one of the new supposedly breakthrough drugs that offered hope to ALS patients is not really panning out. And, you know, they have these accelerated approvals. So accelerated approvals means that drugs for really kind of challenging life-threatening conditions that even have a scintilla of promise are approved with less strict criteria than drugs that are ordinarily approved. And this is sort of on a compassionate basis, it's thought. But on the other hand, people, I have mixed feelings about this because, people try these things with great hope and fanfare sometimes. There's an enormous expenditure either for the patients and their families or for the insurance companies that cover these therapies that can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and even millions of dollars, and then they don't work. So ALS still remains a challenge. An invariably fatal disease. And they have, this study came out, chemicals stored in home garages linked to ALS risk.
Oh, no.
Isn't that interesting?
What chemical?
Okay, well, the chemicals, there's a witch's brew of chemicals that people store in their garage, and people often have attached garages. So storage containing volatile chemicals in garages is extremely common, whether it's in a car or a motorcycle, equipment like a chainsaw or solvents, cleaners, paints, and other items. You know, so you keep them out of the house, you know, like your paint stripper or your pesticides, whatever. And, your husband is handy and, hopefully,
All that stuff is in the shop, right?
Okay.
Which is detached.
Oh, good. Okay. Okay. So you actually,
which is detached.
You designed a new house and, he does a lot of work and, frankly, this exposure to different things. So, it still is a mystery why people get ALS. Is it a diet thing? Well, maybe to a lesser extent than cancer and heart disease, but maybe diet plays a role. But there's definitely a higher risk with chemical exposure. Now, so the question, and there's actually another companion article that I linked to this, household chemicals linked to brain health risks, oligodendrocyte damage. There are certain household chemicals that either kill or prevent the maturation of oligodendrocytes, which are the things that create synapses in the brain. Quaternary ammonium compounds and disinfectants may have concerning effects linked to neurological outcomes in children, flame
and
retardants.
Boy, did a lot of people use a lot of disinfectants in 2020 and 2021 and ever since.
Right. So we were, it's the unintended consequences of this absolute terror we had of COVID is we may have subjected ourselves to other risks of even more serious disease. It's, just drenching ourselves with antimicrobials and
antimicrobials, antibacterials, disinfectants, so much Lysol. Oh my goodness. So much hand sanitizer. Wow.
But there's the question remains, and here's another real coincidence. ALS, known as Lou Gehrig's disease. By an amazing coincidence, Lou Gehrig developed Lou Gehrig's disease. Okay, since I went to coincidence. So it was named after him because he really put that disease front and center because he was in the prime of his life. He was in his 30s. He was an amazing baseball player for the Yankees, broke all kinds of records. And then he was humbled and ultimately succumbed to this fatal disease. And he gave this, if you saw the movie with Gary Cooper, he gave this heart-rending speech.
Yes.
In Yankee Stadium and, then departed the scene only to die within a few months of ALS. So, but how did he get it? Was he storing bad chemicals in the garage or, what's the theory there? They had an interesting theory. And it actually turns out that athletes, have a higher rate of ALS. And this is, I looked it up and, I queried, how did Lou Gehrig get Lou Gehrig's disease? There's a theory that there's a bacteria called M. avium, which lives in manure, soil, dirt, dust, and grass. And it may be responsible for the clusters that we see of Lou Gehrig's disease in football, rugby, and soccer players. Now, I'll also point out that these playing fields are
eat a lot of dirt.
They're exposed to a lot of dirt and dust, and maybe there's an infectious cause. But I would also point out that these fields are often drenched in herbicides and potentially pesticides and chemicals. Now, I don't know if that was the case in the 1930s and 1940s. I believe it was in the 1930s that he played in 1940s. Because I don't know if the use of those chemicals was as prevalent as it is now. But there's, they say outdoor sports players may develop ALS after multiple oral, nasal, or subcutaneous doses of M. avium present in the dirt, dust, and grass of the playing fields. Now, that's just a theory. And it's speculative why ALS develops or occurs.
Lou Gehrig died June 1941.
There you go. So he
played definitely in the 30s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one can speculate, but it is, it's a dread disease. I don't know that there's any strong evidence for nutritional supplements, although there's some, It's thought that some subtypes of ALS may respond to antioxidant treatment. And, you know, we've worked with a few ALS patients to support them. I found that...
And their detox pathways. Detox.
Yeah.
Top of the list.
But I cannot tell you that I've got, you know, a slam dunk panacea-like fix for patients with ALS. Mm-hmm. It's what we offer them is maybe, you know, supportive nutrition. I've given some of the men with ALS testosterone because it is a muscle wasting disease and testosterone is anabolic. And that may have helped to improve quality of life while they were, disease was progressing. But
yeah,
I don't know. I just don't know. You know, if somebody's got like, you know, maybe we've got a clinician who really thinks that they have, they've hit the lottery on ALS treatment. Hey, share with us your impressions about what could work. Because it's really quite the clinical challenge.
And Parkinson's, which is another...
Parkinson's, I think there are more plausible connections. You know, for example, there's microbiome treatments. And there's even, I think, a study that says that fecal transfer, it's a pilot study, but they found that fecal transfer can slow the progression of Parkinson's because there's such a gut-brain connection.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, energetics, you know, high-dose coenzyme Q10, although some of the studies were not promising on that. A vitamin E study didn't pan out. Maybe NAD support.
IV glutathione.
Sure.
IV glutathione was almost magic, but you have to get it a lot.
Yeah. And that's David Perlmutter was a pioneer in offering that at his center when he was practicing. These are challenging conditions, but.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the Bredesen protocol for Alzheimer's and cognitive decline, you know, which is kind of an all of the above approach, you know, looking at sleep and looking at exercise and looking at nutritional support and, you know.
Blood sugar.
Yeah, blood, big time.
Insulin resistance to the brain,
diet,
all of that.
Ketogenic diet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I think, Dr. Hoffman, this may be a good time to pause for one of our sponsors.
The pause that refreshes. It's always a good time for the pause that refreshes when one of our sponsors wants to strut their stuff before our audience. So here goes. Listen up. As you know, I'm a big proponent of CBD to tonify the endocannabinoid system, which regulates many of our most critical bodily functions, such as learning and memory, emotional processing, sleep, temperature, and pain control, and inflammatory and immune responses. CBD is a real breakthrough in herbal products. But you may not know that CBD can deliver the same healthful results for your pets. The CBD brand that I take personally and recommend to my patients is Plus CBD from CV Sciences, which is now proud to introduce Premier CBD Chews tailored for dogs. Plus CBD pet wellness treats are crafted with the utmost care and supported by extensive research validated by a landmark safety study backed by the National Animal Supplement Council. There are two varieties, Plus CBD Pet Hip and Joint Health Chews and Plus CBD Pet Calming Care Chews. To learn more and to order, visit pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman and use coupon code Hoffman30 for 30% off. That's pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman for Plus CBD's pet wellness blends. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make intelligent medicine continuing free resource to you. And, you know, hopefully you find that these interruptions in our podcast actually can be informative because you know, we try to point you in the direction of products that we think are valuable. So let us proceed. Questions at dearhoffman.net, the destination for questions. And we've got a pretty good mailbag to address today. So let's hit it.
Okay. We've got a question here from a doctor. I'm going to call him Dr. Richard.
Mm-hmm.
I am an active 75-year-old male with a history of stent placement 2 years ago and recently had a mild chest pain. So an angiogram showed open stents, and there was a presumptive diagnosis of microvascular disease.
Mm-hmm.
He's been taking Crestor for 30 years.
Out there on that thought. So there is there are different variants of ischemic heart disease. I mean, there's a lot of heart problems.
Yeah.
You're going to have valvular problems. You're going to have atrial fibrillation. But ischemic heart disease means you don't get enough blood flow, so you could get a heart attack or you have angina, pain with exertion, or, you know, the potential for a heart attack or heart failure. And ischemic means there's not enough circulation. So there's a couple of ways you can have not enough circulation. One is the big pipes can be blocked. And those are the major coronary vessels, like the left anterior descending and the right coronary artery and, you know, circumflex. And, you know, there's a distinct anatomy, and it's kind of like the major highways. And when they're blocked, they're pretty big tunnels, and you can go in there and you can Roto-Rooter them and stent them, you know, put in like a little metal device that keeps them open. And so that's what's called macrovascular disease, which is the majority of heart disease that's ischemic. And then there's instances like this guy where it, you know, you do an angiogram and you say, hey, there's all the blood vessels, the major ones that we can see are open, but you're having a lack of circulation. So the presumptive diagnosis is that you have microvascular disease. The little tiny blood vessels are not delivering blood to the heart. And that actually is it's a distinct entity, and it's kind of a problematic entity in cardiology because it's less amenable to a fix, you know, where you can go in and you can stent macrovascular disease where you have, you know, narrowing or blockage, but you have these tiny, tiny blood vessels, these are too small to open up. So it's actually more common in women than in men. It's a finding that we sometimes see in women is that a normal angiogram, but ischemia, you know, signs that the heart's not getting enough blood. And it's thought that in women, you know, it's a little different. And there may also be a stress thing. And that occurs when there's vasospasm. You know, vasospasm can occur in an open vessel, but when under stress, you know, people can actually get a heart attack from stress. I mean, that's like, you know,
absolutely
scared to death, you know, that whole, it's a thing. You can actually have so much of the stress hormones and, you know, adrenaline, cortisol that, your blood vessels, become constricted and you don't get enough circulation. So, but more common in women than, but not, you know, not unknown in men. So, you know, presumably it's a correct diagnosis. So, keep going. So what's going on with this guy?
Here's the thing. Dr. Hoppen, he's 75. He's been taking 20 milligrams of Crestor for 30 years due to familial hypercholesterolemia. He's also on blood pressure meds. And he still needed the stent 2 years ago, despite being on Crestor for 30 years.
Well, that's very common now.
I have an idea.
But, you know, it's a very
common thing. Virtually
everybody who has had a heart attack, gets a heart attack these days, has been on these medications, and they're somewhat helpful.
Right.
But they're not 100%.
Yeah. But he's been on it for 30 years already.
Yeah.
And only recently needed the stent placement. My question is, there has been some evidence in the research that these statins kind of mess with vitamin K the wrong way. And may contribute to some of these plaques.
Right.
Besides that increase in diabetes, and I know that was more in women than in men, but, you know, I think about this. He's been taking this medication for 30 years that was supposed to help. It obviously didn't help.
Right. So there's a lot of possibility. You know, first of all, it might have helped. You know, for all we know, he could be dead by now if he hadn't taken a statin. So it might have helped, but he's, you know, still
That's
in
true
trouble.
Too. That's true
so,
too. Yeah.
It's only partially effective. The other issue is statins only deal with some of the risks. They deal with the risk associated with high cholesterol, but they don't deal with LPA. They don't deal with inflammation like C-reactive protein. I mean, they do a little bit too. They reduce
inflammation. Yeah, and they don't deal with homocysteine either.
They don't deal with homocysteine. They don't deal with insulin resistance and, you know, maybe he has hemoglobin A1C of 6.1 or 6.2, which is not really fully full-blown diabetic, but it increases the risk for cardiovascular disease. I don't know what his height and weight are. I don't know what his exercise status is. I don't know some things that might be unaddressed risk factors for him. And therefore, you know, he should get kind of a comprehensive risk factor assessment. I do know that exercise is generally helpful for enhancing coronary circulation. And yes. So, you know, he has to be careful because he can't overdo it, but a little bit of stress can help him to revascularize around those tiny arteries that are not delivering enough blood to his heart. You know, so
he's already taking things like ubiquinol,
good,
omega-3s. Mm-hmm. He has no symptoms. All the blood work is normal. Any other supplement recommendations?
He might take some nitrates, like the Berkeley Life nitric oxide thing,
yeah,
because that's a vasodilator. Yeah. You know, magnesium certainly. Get the vitamin K.
Vitamin K.
Berberine potentially. Because there's some cardio benefits to berberine, or grapeseed extract or pycnogenol for circulatory benefits. We probably think of a lot of things that he could be doing, but I'm just wondering if something is missing from the analysis, like why, in the face of lowering cholesterol, is his risk progressing, and maybe there's something that's being missed. He's a doctor, so he has a good understanding of what's going on. He probably has good access to, excellent medical care, because doctors are pretty good consumers generally of medical care. They find themselves to good colleagues, cardiologists and so on. But, maybe there's a dimension missing. Maybe he's on an abysmal diet,
All possibilities, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Richard, thank you for your email. Let us know how you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Let's see here. We've got a question from Erwin. Oh, this is a very interesting question. Scientists tell us that good bacteria like Bifidus or Rhamnosus, for example, aid our digestion. They help us to build healthy microbiomes. How do the bacteria work? Are they alive and active?
Mm-hmm.
If I put a dab of yogurt on a slide and look at it under a microscope, will I see live bacteria moving around?
Mm-hmm.
And do the good bacteria in yogurt also function as possible antibiotics by attacking bad bacteria in our digestive tracts? I'm confused about the benefits of yogurt and how much to consume each day.
Well,
what a thoughtful question.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because... there are live bacteria in yogurt that's not ultra-pasteurized, and to a greater or lesser extent, commercial yogurts contain live cultures. So they work in a couple of ways. One is they do introduce good bacteria into the intestinal tract. Some of the bacteria makes its way into the intestinal tract and colonizes and increases your level of the good bacteria. Now, these good bacteria also displace the bad bacteria and compete with them. And sometimes, they have the ability to secrete antimicrobial compounds that suppress the growth of the bad bacteria. So, in effect, they are like natural antimicrobials against bad guys, against the bad guys. The other thing they do is they actually may signal I've heard it, and I'll credit one of my good colleagues, Dr. Leo Galland, with this explanation, is that Alexander the Great, conquered the world, but it was through orchestrating armies at his command that he did it. He didn't do it single-handedly. The thought is that certain probiotics can act as generals to marshal other probiotics that are within the intestinal tract. And you don't need much, just a little bit to get that effect. So like one, extraordinary individual can mobilize an entire society to conquer the world. And the thought is that even if a small amount gets in, it can actually create profound changes within the gastrointestinal tract via the signaling that occurs between the microbes in your intestinal tract. So there's that. There's also the what are called postbiotics, the things that the bacteria make that are healthful, you know, like butyrate, for example. Butyrate
yes.
is really mm-hmm. good. Butyrate is good in the gut. It's good in the brain, you know, and it may be good in the body. Mm-hmm. So, and
the other thing is,
go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
How much yogurt to consume each day? First of all, you know, if you have a dairy allergy, you don't want to get your probiotics from yogurt. You want to take a supplement or have a non-dairy yogurt, like a coconut yogurt. There's coconut kefir and other things like that, or even water kefir. That could be something. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, there are a lot of other prebiotic and probiotic foods to eat as well. A lot of our foods that we already eat, especially produce, plant foods, things like that, have prebiotics in them to help feed the beneficial bacteria in the gut. So that is helpful.
In other words, like you can get an effect not even taking probiotics, but with prebiotics that encourage the growth of the good species. So
exactly.
In effect, I mean, if you're on a really crappy diet and you have no beneficial prebiotics, you're going to have a bad microbiome with or without the exactly. yogurt or the kimchi or taking
right.
acidophilus pills or taking Dr. Ahira's essential formulas. It's really, you got to be in a healthy diet with prebiotics in your diet.
Right. And the other thing is, don't be misled in that if I eat so much yogurt or have so much probiotic every day, I can continue with my standard American diet, which mm-hmm. is crappy.
Yeah. No,
and that's not the way to go either,
exactly.
because a lot of people will do that. Say, oh, well, I have my yogurt up, so it's okay. I can indulge in this carrot cake. No, you really don't want to. Wait until Sunday or do something different.
Yeah.
Because even the sugar, besides processed food, sugar itself will feed bad bacteria mm-hmm. as well.
And they're chemicals.
And if you're taking, yeah.
They're chemicals that kill off
taking,
your flora too, like the glyphosate
that's true.
Sprayed on foods.
On the food,
is actually,
yes.
It's an herbicide and bacteria actually, you know, have the same in some ways, metabolism that weeds have, and you actually may mm-hmm. suppress beneficial bacteria. You know, you drink a lot of fluoridated water, and those are antiseptics. You take antibiotics.
Yes.
You take disinfectant, toothpaste or things like that, or, swallow some of the Listerine. You know, you're actually going to kill some of the – you're taking a disinfectant in your mouth, and that actually has an impact on your microbiome. So, you know.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of ways that we can go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just anecdotally, I'll
okay.
tell you, I went to, mm-hmm. I went to Iceland, and in Iceland, they had great breakfasts. And one of my favorite things at breakfast was skyr. And it's like a really like, it's like that Greek yogurt.
Yeah.
It's like really like a rich yogurt and it's really delicious. And I got into this skyr thing and, then I bought skyr in the supermarkets and I swim a lot. And all of a sudden I was becoming like tremendously congested with my swimming. And I said, I don't want to stop swimming, but I'm consuming like a large amount of really concentrated dairy every day. And I don't have like a really heavy duty dairy allergy where, you know, I go into anaphylaxis when I have dairy, but it's too much dairy is very mucus forming. And so,
and you know what,
yeah,
Dr. Hoffman, that doesn't have to be a dairy allergy. Dairy simply makes mucus and phlegm.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I often tell patients if they feel like they're coming down with a cold or they have a lot of congestion, even during allergy season, stay away from the dairy to kind of slow all that down.
Yep. Yeah.
And, certainly hydrate enough to thin it all out. You want to hydrate.
So I went cold turkey on skyr and dairy products and. Yeah, you know, it took a few weeks to resolve.
It's fun on vacation.
It got better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All
right.
This is all the time we have for part one. We're going to endeavor to get through the rest of our questions in part two. Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to tackle in part two.
Yeah. I've had GERD for about 20 years, and I found out that my swallowing doesn't work that well. And the sphincter is overly tight, not letting the food pass quickly enough into my stomach.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll deal with that question when we return. It's not an uncommon complaint. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin, because it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. And Questions can come to questions@drhoffman.net. We'll be back with more of today's podcast with part two. So stay with us.